Welcome, everyone, to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many international lodges that have one idea in mind, and that is to spread broadcast the teachings of the philosophy of theosophy. And we will start off by reading the declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So in order for this lodge to accomplish these lofty goals that were put forth in the declaration, we do hold two meetings a week. As now on Sundays, we have a different type of setup each week. Today we're having a forum. We sometimes have a lecture. And sometimes we have a panel discussion on a certain theosophical topic. Today we're looking at removing the cause of sorrow. Next Sunday we have a special meeting. It's ULT Day, and it's mission and future. And we just ask that maybe people can come into the meeting room a little bit early to kind of settle in, and we'll be looking at the founding of the United Lodge of Theosophists. On Wednesdays, we have a study class, and we're doing something new this season. We're looking at the back section of Answers to Questions by Robert Crosby. And the meeting on Wednesday, we have a library that opens at 5:15 and closes at 7:15. It is a reference library, and there is always a student available to let you know what that topic is for the night and that we're going to be discussing, and also the reference that will be available to read. And if you have any special type of study that you wish to endeavor, the student can help you find resources for that as well. The meeting runs from 7:30 until 8:30, and the book table is open before and after all meetings. On Sundays, our building opens at 10:30. The meeting runs from 11 until 12. And as always, there's always time for questions and discussion after the presentations. The United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So we will be looking at a very interesting topic. It's called removing the cause of sorrow, which is something that we could say that most people are looking at trying to remove any of the causes of sorrow. But Theosophy looks at the cause of sorrow very differently than a lot of the other religions look at. We look at it as something that's self-responsibility, not an outside God. So we will have a short talk. We have a student who will give us a presentation. Then afterwards, we'll have plenty of time for discussion and questions.
One of the most common experiences of life is connected with sorrow and suffering. And men and women experience sorrow. All men and women experience sorrow. That feeling of immense sadness, the pang of the heart, the agony of the mind, the disease of the body are all too common in us as in others. If we could see and understand the cause of sorrow existing in the world in every direction, not only the sorrows of ordinary life, but those brought about by collective action, such as in wars, we should cease to make that cause. Each one of us has had sorrow in his life, but each also has had their share of happiness and pleasure. If we harp on our woes and misery and forget our joys and happiness, it is because of a psychological reason. We humans are awakened much more by our pains and sorrows than by our pleasurable experiences. We sit up and take notice when things go wrong. Happiness for ourselves just seems so natural. Within our own soul, there is bliss. Pleasures come and go very lightly, but always the sorrow and suffering of life itself abides within us. Therefore, it seems quite natural to experience joy, but this naturalness has bred a kind of apathy. We take our pleasures for granted, and we fail to learn very much from them. But when pain and sorrow and suffering and or afflictions come along, they awaken us and get our immediate attention. We have assumed that all these sorrows are due to external causes, to some higher being or beings, or to some outside laws of the universe, never to ourselves. And because we have never brought it home to ourselves, never thinking that we are in any way connected with the cause of sorrow which come our way, we go on looking for something external to relieve us of those sorrows. Not all the religions that have ever existed on the face of the earth, not all that the sciences have so far achieved or may achieve, will ever give us the knowledge to end our sorrows. And that is because the cause of sorrow does not lie outside. It lies within each one. Each one contains within himself the power to cause sorrow. And also, they have the power, each one of us, to cause its cessation. Let us consider the idea held by many that wealth is the womb of happiness and poverty begets sorrow and suffering. False as it might seem, there is an ounce of underlying truth in that belief. We are apt, especially in this civilization, with economics and politics, where economics and politics are the dominating forces, to look upon wealth only from the point of view of monies and stocks and bonds, cars. We tend to overlook the important fact that the real value of wealth lies in the use we make of it. But there are other kinds of wealth. There is mental wealth, and there is emotional purchase. For a small amount of money, we can purchase a copy of the Bhagavad Gita or the Dhammapada. But the joy and inspiration one derives for days and months and years is priceless. So it is not just money that gives us enjoyment, but the power to use money to secure that which to us means happiness. The very common phenomenon of the rich who are unhappy and of the poor who are content and happy further proves that the real source of happiness and sorrow is within ourselves. The wisdom of the ages explains the cause of sorrow. It teaches that each being is spirit, and that the power of spirit is unlimited. It is we, you and I, that limit it, because we assume that it is limited. Theosophy posits that the chainless spirit in the heart of every being is behind every form, the cause and sustainer of all forms, and that this spirit is the force behind evolution, and also the force that rules and regulates all things of whatever position, and that every being is the result of an unfoldment from within outward. And we all have a desire for great and greater expression. But we who have reached the edge or the stage of self-consciousness, unlike the lower kingdoms, now have the power of choice. And we can draw upon that infinite source of our being and realize it while we live in a mortal and ever-changing body. Desire, in a limited way with regard to the personality, is the cause of all sin, sorrow, and suffering. Such desire is based on selfish thought. It is not what others desire. It heeds not any other urge than its own. It is the unfulfilled desires that hurt us. We would think then that the fulfilled desires we have had give us happiness, but they never seem to do that. For as soon as they are achieved, there begins a further desire for something more, something better, something greater, something more satisfying. The Gita teaches that light and darkness are the world's eternal ways. Nature as a whole is neither good nor evil. The light of day is not more or less valuable than the darkness of night. The flow of the tide is as valuable as the ebb. Summer is as useful as winter, and so on and so on. Spirit and matter are not two different realities, but two poles of one life. Just as our globe, the Earth, has two poles, and without both, there would be no globe, so also in the universe are spirit and matter. Everywhere in nature, in all things and beings, spirit and matter exist. Representatives, aspects of both, are present in every advanced spiritual being and in every atom. Only the proportion of these aspects is different. In an adept, the spirit aspect is more active than the material aspect. In the mineral, the material aspect is more active. and man, spirit and matter, are both equally represented. As a result of this, there springs into being that which we call the thinking, reasoning, self-determining human soul. Because of the presence of free will, man has the power to choose and to determine. Being in that middle position, it can also go in either of two directions. It can soar spiritward or drift into the abyss of matter. It is man and no one else who is the creator of that which we call good and evil, happiness and its opposites. To evaluate beauty, we need to contact its opposite. Similarly, to experience the supreme and sublime bliss of nirvana, we need to experience the sorrow and suffering of material existence. All that we experience now was created by us in the past. We are reaping today the effects of seeds sown by us earlier. Weaknesses and ailments of the body, defects of character, limitations of the mind, and all the results of our own thoughts, feelings, and actions. Past deeds, past desires, past ideas have produced our present body, character, mind, and also our circumstances and environment. So just how, by what precise method did we create all this? The Buddha answered that, and so does the Gita. And the answer of theosophy is the same. The Buddha said that the cause of sorrow, the second of the Four Noble Truths, is desire, and the cause of desire is kamma. The very first idea to grasp, and which is often neglected, is that if kamma, desire, produces suffering and sorrow, its reverse must produce happiness and joy. If kamma, desire, anger, covetousness, and the gates of hell, as the Gita teaches, then compassion, which is the reverse of passion, patience, the reverse of anger, generosity, the reverse of greed, are the gates to heaven. Because of ignorance of our own nature and of our human constitution, we are deluded by that which we call pleasure. Most men and women think of pleasure and happiness in terms of their five senses. For instance, what tastes good is eaten without any consideration of the value of the food. We indulge it because it gives a thrill to our palate. Then pain comes. We know it, and yet we continue to indulge in it. The voice of flesh brings misery. The voice of conscience brings warning. The voice of the soul brings happiness. One more thought, if you will. Without deliberate practice, no one can overcome pain and sorrow. No one can bring about real joy of the heart and peace of the mind. We must work for our spiritual wealth, just as we labor to earn our livelihood. Theosophy gives us adequate tools for gaining the knowledge for this task. We have but to avail and to apply. And lastly, from that great Australian philosopher, Helen Reddy, "Oh yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom born of pain. Yes, I've paid the price, but look how much I've gained. If I have to, I can do anything." Once again, the topic for today is removing the cause of sorrow.
So one thing we need to put out there is that we have to experience some sort of unhappiness, sorrow, however, whatever you want to call it, because this is how we learn our lessons. So, you know, we have to, it's our motive, it's our perspective when it comes to these unhappy times. So we're hoping that during the meeting, we will be able to come upon some kind of consensus to see how it is, as the title of our class today is Removing the Cause of Sorrow. And we were given quite a few gems that can spark our discussions. There's many things we can look at. We can look at karma, choice, will and desire. So there's any number of ways we can have the meeting go. Yes?
Well, isn't the basis for all of this it's in desire, but isn't it selfishness? Isn't it separateness? There's, the pain we suffer is because we think that we deserve something, or we're not getting something, or something is painful. We don't deserve it. All these things and feelings, but it's basically our selfishness. I think the Gita says, renounce everything. If you don't desire it, how can you want it? So it seems rather abstract to not desire anything. But we are told the least you desire is the better off you will be.
Well, we have to look at the idea that we're in Kali Yuga, we're in the Dark Age, which is very materialistic and very self-centered. So if we're looking at selfishness, it's, these are experiences that we have to learn, and they're experiences that we have to learn to overcome. So because we're in such a highly materialistic age, it almost automatically sets up this idea of selfishness, because there's more that we want. And the theosophical principle of universal brotherhood is trying to break that cycle. And in order to break it, we have to become aware of exactly what it is that life truly is, which, as was said in the talk, we were talking about compassion, and that is the greatest example of how we can break that cycle. Yes?
Well, if Buddha says that the cause of all sorrow is desire, but yet we're born pre-programmed to live, pre-programmed to eat, to earn a living, to desire the love of our family, etc., etc. How is it that we're supposed to get rid of desire if we're pre-programmed with it as we come into this world?
So what do we do with desire, basically? It's not a characteristic that we want to get rid of. We want to raise up that idea of desire. When one usually speaks of desire, there's usually a negative connotation to it. But theosophy also says that everything is dual. So there is a dual aspect to desire. There are higher desires. There are those desires to do good. There's those desires to love, to do for others. So it's not, we want to transpose that lower desire for materialism to higher desires of a more spiritual nature. Yes?
In a sense, we've programmed ourselves that we believe our belief system is in everything outside of us, and we worship outside of us, and that the fact that if we have a discussion, and the idea eternal beings, that this is just one life of many, and that we're here to raise everything up. That means ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as just stated, that if you have higher desires, a desire for a spiritual life, and a desire for peace and understanding, you know, those desires will be fulfilled. We don't have faith in ourselves. What we want and what we desire comes to pass. It's just that we see what's happened to the world because we've been desiring all these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's all material things. So I think the point that we are such dynamic beings that we create the universe. We've created this world in which we live. We're the creators of it. So if we've created it, we can certainly change it and unprogram ourselves. And we can only do that by the ideas that we hold to be true.
So we need to, as was said, reprogram ourselves to understand that because of the way things are now, we can be, it says, come ye out and be ye separate. So because of the fact that we're living in a highly materialistic, individualist world, doesn't mean that we have to act that way. And by realizing that the change has to come from within, that we don't need to rely on a priest, on an outside God, that as long as we teach ourselves, that we gain the knowledge of an inward spiritual life, then we can come ye out and be ye separate. We don't have to act like so many people are in regards to materialism. So we have that option. And the whole idea comes down to choice. We are self-conscious beings. The lower kingdoms don't have the benefit of self-consciousness. So the choices they make are from a natural impulse. But we can make individual choices. And if we can get enough knowledge, it was mentioned about the Bhagavad Gita, it was mentioned about the Buddhist teachings, then if we can learn and actually inculcate these teachings into our being, then that spiritual life can come through. So when we're talking about the cause of sorrow, we also have to look at the idea, as was mentioned, desire. We hear a lot about behind will stands desire, but desire is the impetus, and then the action comes through will. So our desires need to be elevated then. And there's so many things that are coming together to remove this cause of sorrow, because with will and desire, we have to make the choice as to which way we're going to go with the desire. Is it going to be a higher desire or a lower desire? When will kicks in, will is colored by the desire principle. And then karma, of course, is the result of the choice of will, of desire, because then in a future life, the choices that we made based upon will and desire will be able then to see if we've learned any of these lessons. So
talk about sin, sorrow, and suffering, and if we suffer, but we don't learn anything from our suffering. Is our karma somehow balanced, or do we continue to suffer?
So what happens when we don't learn from our suffering then? It's probably going to be something that we're going to have to attend to in a future life. And we were going to put out, this seems to be a good segue, we were going to put out to the group a question about, can one mitigate their karma, their suffering, or can they mitigate somebody else's suffering? But we know that karma, no matter what, has to be, when the earth gets unbalanced, the universal energy gets unbalanced when something wrong is done. And it has to be balanced out. So if somebody is suffering now, as the question was asked, and they don't do anything about it, at some point in time, that has to be balanced out. If that person is still suffering, but is helping others despite that suffering, is doing good, has that idea of universal brotherhood, but still is an acceptance of their own suffering, then that will still have to be balanced out. You're not going to wipe away what you've done. But by helping others, that also will be part of a future life that you did good. Yes?
Well, as for mitigating karma, we don't think that mitigating means making it go away. Maybe we're just mitigating the effect that it has on us. And an example, we can think of two examples. One would be we get ourselves into an astronomical amount of credit card debt, and we're not keeping up, and we're paying the fees. One can suffer through that and not, endlessly not know how to get, or pull themselves together, get a second job, or make a move and learn things in their own job and get promoted and grow, and as a result have a much larger income, so that credit card debt suddenly becomes a check that I got to pay every month, and fortunately I'll have it done by X date. So the karma of the interest, you're still going to pay every penny of interest, but the effect that it has on the person who's grown through the depression of having debt is nowhere near what it could be. And then, another example would be, there's plenty of people who are dealing with certain kinds of depression, and if you know when and where and how it's going to come about, if you track yourself, if you know yourself, you can put things in place to counteract that by making sure, for instance, that at certain times of the week or something, that you're with friends and not by yourself. Or by making sure, a lot of people will fall into depression. It's the effect of eating unhealthy food. Just stay away from that. There's a way we can mitigate it. Doesn't mean it goes away, but
no, by mitigating doesn't mean that you're going to wipe away. You're not. You always will have to pay for what you've done. Yes?
Well, I think it's stated that you can pass over all these problems in the work of spiritual knowledge. Just knowing who you are and what you are, and that you're the creator of all that you experience.
Mm-hmm.
Take responsibility for your life, and things begin to change. But the reality is that you're the witness of what's going on. You're not what's going on. You're the witness of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're more than that, and that's what we oftentimes forget. We don't step back and look at life impersonally. Everything's personal. Someone says something, you take it personally, and then the emotions become and create our world in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to decide, well, let's take responsibility for it, and let's create something different. So the ideas that you hold are what you become. That's where we are. All these ideas that we held in the past are flowering now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, taking responsibility. That is like the main thing we need to take away, is that nobody else, we can't blame what's happening on anybody else, or we can't blame it, you know, God did this to me. We have to learn, as was stated, spiritual knowledge and acceptance of where we are, and realize that, as we were saying, we have choices. We may, sometimes things get so bad that you don't need, I mean, not that you don't need, you don't see that you have choices. But as was just said in the comment, we have to take a step back and just kind of be calm, sit and see where we are. We have to, sometimes we have to change our perspective about life, our lives and our families, and see how we can change. That's the whole thing, is that we can change. We have to realize we have the choice to change. We have to have that desire to change, which will kick in the will so that we can actually function and move. And then our karma, you know, we're going to be looking at how all these changes will affect our karma in a next life. So, yes?
Regarding mitigating karma, as was just stated, it's all about your personal choices. There was a great master called Paramahansa Yogananda, and he said the following quote. He said that the seeds of the past karma cannot germinate in the fires of divine wisdom. Meaning that if you transcend yourself and behave yourself to such a state that your karmic lessons no longer apply to you, then those karmic lessons will not be given to you, because you have transcended that, those karmic lessons. You are beyond them. So if you can transcend or elevate yourself to the point where the previous karmic lessons that you weren't going to be given no longer apply to you, you have just circumvented your karma.
Well, Theosophy would say that whatever karma you have created is something that you're going to have to pay for. We can't transcend them. So there are lessons that we have to learn, and we have to pay attention to that. And the karma that we've created will come back to us at some point in time. And it's our duty, with whatever comes to us, that we do have to pay for it. Yes?
Well, another metaphor for spiritual knowledge is light. Is the light is a flame, it's burning. It consumes everything. You know, that spiritual knowledge gives an understanding of the divine, of reality. It's beyond perhaps our ability to express it, but the spiritual knowledge is that we're beginning a grasp on that witness that we are. You know, the Gita says, within everyone, every is Ishwara,
mm-hmm.
The great warrior, the witness. So we need to find that warrior within us. We need to, you know, find that unchanging spot within our consciousness that does not change.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes our refuge, which is Ishwara.
Yeah, our goal should probably be to learn these spiritual lessons. Not only just reading the, you know, the wonderful books that we have, But theosophy in the Declaration talks about inculcating these ideas into your life. And that's, once we do all that reading, it's fine if it's just sitting there in your head, but it has to be taken in. And when we do take it in, and we can do that by meditating on these ideas, when they take hold, this is when these choices, this perspective that we have upon our life, upon the sorrows that we're experiencing. And it was interesting in the talk that if we're experiencing happiness, we're not really aware of what it is that we are experiencing. But we do know when we're experiencing unhappiness or sorrow, then that really affects us. And that's when we feel as though we need to make the changes. But if we're having a good life, if we're financially comfortable, then we have to pay it forward. So, yes.
So, we're all familiar with happiness, but there's something called bliss. Is there a difference between happiness and bliss? Because we're told that our true state should be blissful. And it seems like happiness is transitory, but if one has reached a state of bliss, that they're operating on a whole different plane.
So what is the difference then between happiness and bliss? And our understanding would be that with bliss, it's more of a higher experience than just happiness. If somebody else wants to, yes.
Yeah, but the word happiness actually is a latecomer into the English language, and it's directly related to, it has to do with a person who is able to live his life according to the way he wants to and accept the karma of that. That's what it is. When it came into the English language, it didn't mean joyful. It meant free to do what one will and accept the results of it. And that's an example of the word happy, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That's the happiness that they wanted. That's what they were talking about, was the freedom to live your life. Whereas bliss, I mean, whenever we hear bliss, we think of nirvana. So it almost seems more just of a natural state without conflict, without distraction, just consciousness. You know, it's, whereas happiness is something that is the result of, it's a cause and effect part of karma.
So we're thinking then that happiness has to do with something, whereas bliss would be more of an internal type of...
Originally, the word did mean it has to do literally with karma. It's the result of me doing what I will. And so now, even today, you know, think of, oh, they're a happy couple. Typically means, if it's a young, happy couple, it's probably, yes, they are married, yes, they did have the kids they planned on having. They're reaping the fruits of what they've sown, and that, in that sense, the word happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, today we kind of conflate it with joy, and it does mean joy in our language today, but it helps to understand the origin of it. But we did have another contribution we wanted.
Yes.
As regards whether one can transcend the karma that he's created for himself, an example comes to mind. We had friends some time ago who experienced, okay, first, see, there's an aphorism. One of Mr. Judge's aphorisms on karma is that karma cannot be expressed if you don't give it an instrument to express itself through. Kind of like, you know, if you don't want to go to war, get rid of all the guns. And if you don't have guns, you can't go to war, you know? But in this case, this couple experienced, we'll just say, a breach of trust in their marriage, and made the decision not even to address it because of the age that their children were at the time. It would have been totally destructive to the family. And they agreed, you know, this has to be handled, but we'll handle it when the kids are out. And it was years later, like the kids were in high school or something, and when they came to handle it, it was truly fully addressed. The karma of it was fully addressed, but it wasn't as destructive because they grew in certain ways. They grew in character, they got perspective on it, and they realized, you know, how much value are we going to place on that issue? So if they did give it an instrument to express itself through in the moment, it would have had a different effect than later on when they maybe grew in wisdom. So perhaps this para, the Indian teacher, maybe he was, maybe that has something to do with what he was saying. You know, we find it hard to not, we find it hard to accept that you don't read what you say, no matter who. Mm-hmm.
So, as was said, at some point in time, they're going to have to accept the karma of what has transpired. So whether it's in the moment or not, karma has to be balanced out. Yes?
What about the idea of suffering? I mean, these are great beings who have suffered tremendously. So that has to burn away karma. I mean, may not suffer for the exact same deed that we manifested, but if we have suffered in the pursuit of helping humanity,
mm-hmm.
you know, we are told that, you know, that burns away our karma. That you know, that it's burned away because you're bringing everything to the forefront. You're sacrificing yourself for humanity or for unselfish or selfless reasons. So you're changing the paradigm. If you live in a selfish world, to live in a selfless world is the complete opposite. And that's the world that the Gita points mm-hmm. to. And that's that, and it's sort of like saying, well, this is, if you want to be, have a better world, practice selflessness. First of all, in your family, but then expand it. Mm-hmm. Expand it in the world in which you live.
Well, suffering can certainly mitigate it, but you still, there's still that personal responsibility for what the past was. So it still has to be balanced out in some way. Yes?
Well, we would not want to, but I think the point is that if you're willing to give up the pleasures of life and the pleasures of the of our selfish personality, you know, there's a great deal of suffering there
mm-hmm.
because we're attached to everything. So, you know, even though, you know, the intensity of that suffering is all determined by us, by how much we desire things, how much we value things. So, again, just saying that we would be under the impression that one can mitigate all karma in the act of service to humanity. And we would, you know, look at beings like Mother Teresa or people who were you know, humanitarians. You know, and you know, they're always put up as an example. What our humanity can be.
Mm-hmm. Is this in response? Okay.
Can we all acknowledge that there is some sort of preserver or an observer within us that does see all of this, that can be a help to us if we understood what we're observing?
So
the observer.
Yeah, the observer.
The witness.
Yeah,
can each one acknowledge there is a part of me that is observing all
mm-hmm.
this, but it's
not affecting.
High or low, it's observing.
Yes, there is that observer that is not affected by anything that we're doing. There is. But in regards to the idea of suffering, then that observer is observing the suffering, but then there's the mind that is experiencing it, that suffering. And when we're looking at mitigating, then we can actually think that there has to be a balance point, that what has been done in the past and the mitigation, when if they come together, then the we're having a hard time expressing this. Yes.
Well, I think in a sense bliss is related to this, because when one rises above the pairs of opposites and sees the absolute reasonableness of everything, that everything has a purpose and a season, and so we are that observer, we're above the pairs of opposites, and we can live in a state of bliss knowing that everything makes sense. But we've been enculturated through society and religion to think that it's like a, you know, it's like a gambling in a sense. You're betting on that the Savior is going to save you if you do X, Y, and Z, but that's just perpetuates the whole system of sin, sorrow, and suffering, because it's outside. You're always looking out, so you have to look within. You can't look without. You'll never be happy. You'll never be blissful. You'll never be truly sane unless you can really look within and see that, you know, everything makes sense. It seems illogical, but causes have been set up and lessons need to be learned. And we need to go through this. We need to go through war, famine, you know, all the horrors of that are in store for us, because it's expiation of our past sins. That sin is just an error. We made errors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's better to use the term error, maybe, because sin is kind of loaded.
Right. Right. Thank you. So we have to look at ourselves from, we have to look at how we're acting, how we're choosing from the inside. We can't have these choices made for us. People can suggest, but the ultimate choice as to how we are going to act will come from us. Yes.
Well, to be able to look at our lives from the inside, true inside, implies full and utter connection and awareness of your higher self, namely your soul mind, not just your mental mind. And very few and far between people have been able to achieve that. I mean, you're looking at, you know, maybe a dozen here and there, out of 7 billion. To be able to live life from the awareness of your soul implies, you know, levels of meditation and abilities that you at that point already automatically transcend your karma, to be able to get to that point. So the dice is loaded. Like was previously mentioned, we have to live through all the sins that we've committed, or all the wrongdoings that we've committed previously, whether in this life or others. And once we suffer through all that and hopefully learn from that suffering, then we can achieve that state of enlightenment that will allow us to know that we are one with the entire universe. That's it.
Well, when we're talking about enlightenment, we're looking at like masters or adepts, and they have, over the course of their lives, I mean, they have, karmically, they have been able to look at what they need to do so that they do not make any more karma. But they have learned their lessons karmic, from their karmic mistakes over the course of all of their lives. They've been able to see. They are now at a level where they can actually see what it is that they have done in the past. Whereas we're not at that level. We wouldn't be able to handle seeing some of the errors and wrongdoings that we've done. But the masters, the elder brothers, they are able to do that. They are able to look at a situation and know when it has to be done correctly. But they have met all of their karmic lessons. Yes.
The thought comes to mind, you know, is just to compare one to the other. If we have, you know, well, I mean, we've all had our days, our sorrows in life and everything, but if we just take a hypothetical, two people who have absolutely identical situations and identical sorrows, and it's some bad stuff, and the one is your average Westerner who believes in one life, he may or may not go to heaven, if he gets saved, he will, and is the victim of all this stuff, and he's got all this anger because he's the victim. But another one has been introduced and has accepted some of these ideas of karma and reincarnation and can look at it, not like from some exalted, higher, my infinite soul thing, but just on a practical level, you know what? I already know that there's something to this reincarnation and karma thing, and it makes sense. And so if this is all mine, if I had the power to create it for myself, I have the power to overcome it. Maybe not in this life, but at least there's hope that I eventually will. And so that person, with that frame of mind, simply operating from fundamental principles, is not going to be, in his heart or mind, as bad off and as sorrowful. It might be inspiring to them to do something about it, where the other will continue to, you know, just wallow in his own self-pity because he's a victim.
Right, so that's where these ideas are really helpful, because it certainly takes away the emotional attachment that we have to the situations that we are experiencing. Takes away that poor me kind of an attitude. So it is, it's your choice. It's your choice, but it has, sometimes your choice has to be made on knowledge. And if one has the knowledge of these ideas, then, you know, that can certainly help and change your perspective on things. Yes?
Theosophy speaks of affected beings that have been like we are now, but have been able to perfect themselves mm-hmm. in their spiritual nature, or that spiritual nature. So we're given that as what we can be, because we're told that adept, that wise one, that is really our higher nature, our higher nature. So we have direct access to mm-hmm. it. We just have to want to find a way to access it, have a desire to know, have a desire to be with them spiritually. You know, I mean, we have to desire.
Mm-hmm.
And as was said, that is the root of our motivation.
Right, and it, you know, that they are examples for us as to what can actually happen in the future for us. So we have to end our meeting now, but we do want to just read a short quote. The power of choice is the eternal birthright of each. Through the kingly presence indwelling the true individual self, or ego, who knows his essential unity with all other selves, and whose choice is ever to act for and as the self of all creatures. And just to end, no one can save us but ourselves. Our meeting is over.